Some people study medicine because they want to combine both. No doubt we have to. Can everyone hear? Should we use microphone or you can hear us? You think this microphone is right here? You think this microphone is there?
To survive in the society that we are living, we have to have some financial basis in our lives. And it is the duty of a responsible person to make his economic needs fulfilled in an honest and moral way. But there's something more to life than that, because that can give no fulfillment. Money cannot give anyone real fulfillment. But a purpose of life gives a person inner fulfillment. And the greater the purpose of life, the more fulfillment. The ultimate purpose of life brings about the ultimate fulfillment. And that is what we should all be striving to understand and achieve, the ultimate purpose of life. And to connect all of our activities to that ultimate purpose. So the Bhagavad Gita explains what is truth, what is illusion, what is matter, what is spirit, what is God. To understand these principles is called knowledge, real knowledge. To live by these principles is to pursue the truth. To not live by these principles is to be a part of a great illusion, an illusion that is causing so much dissatisfaction, so much disharmony, so much suffering within the world that we live. There is a need for truth, and there is a need for people who live by that principle. And that is what this Krishna consciousness is humbly trying to present to society. What is the highest, most noble truth, and how to live every aspect of our life in pursuance of that truth. To understand the relationship between the Atma, the spirit, and the body. What is this material nature? This material nature composed of the eight material elements: earth, water, fire, air, mind, intelligence, false ego. And how this material covering, although temporary by nature, affects the soul, which is transcendent, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. How we can utilize this temporary vehicle in which we are now residing pursue the natural function of the soul in its relationship with God or Krishna. To understand and to live by this is truth. So you are all practicing to be doctors, and no doubt you will make some nice income, you will get some nice prestige within society for your work. But people, because of their departure from truth, are suffering terribly. Because of their identification with this body and the various types of activities they perform through their body, there is so much suffering. And it is a noble purpose which is fulfilling to the heart, not to just selfishly consume, but to help others, to show compassion, to be a friend, to relieve distress of other living beings. And as a doctor, you are being trained and equipped to do, according to your capacity, just that service of relieving people from suffering. And that will give fulfillment. If you are actually performing your profession with a genuine concern for the condition of others, that will give you fulfillment. But what will give you the ultimate fulfillment is when you help people to understand the ultimate relief from all suffering. And that is to give transcendental knowledge along with physical welfare. Transcendental knowledge of how people can become enlightened, how people could realize the eternal blissful condition of their own soul, to teach people how to serve God, to love God. That is the greatest doctor. The doctor who is concerned with a person's body, mind, and soul. Just to have a healthy body does not necessarily bring a person happiness. People who commit suicide generally do not because they're in physical conditions of suffering. People commit suicide because they're in mental distress. Mental distress is more severe than physical distress. And how much mental distress there is in this world, and how much physical distress. But beyond these physical, gross and physical forms of suffering, there is also the loneliness, the unfulfilled condition of the heart, which is longing and seeking for immortality and for perfect love, which can only be fulfilled in Krishna or in God. So what is the greatest doctor? The doctor who can heal the body, the mind, and the soul. The doctor who knows his profession well enough to know exactly how to treat the body according to the particular disease and bring relief. The person who can speak and live in such a gentle and humble way that we can encourage a person's mind and put their mind at ease. But most important, the doctor who can diagnose the real disease that everyone is suffering, the disease of ignorance, avidya, which has separated us from our own eternal, blissful nature, and give the medicine to that disease, and treat a person so that he could gradually come back to his healthy spiritual condition. So these are the types of the doctors that this world is in the greatest need of. Doctors of the body, mind, and soul. And you all have the opportunity to do this ultimate welfare work, the greatest service to all humanity. And the greater the service, the greater the fulfillment you can give others, and the greater fulfillment you can experience yourself in your own life. What we give is what we receive. So you should understand what a rare and precious fortune that Krishna is giving you all. And really, to show your appreciation for this fortune, you simply have to be very enthusiastic and sincere to receive the gift of this knowledge, this way of life. The name of God is the medicine that can cleanse the disease of ignorance from our hearts and bring us back to our natural health, which is eternal, full of knowledge and full of joy. So we take the name of God in our own life. You have heard the saying, physician, heal thyself. A drowning man cannot save another drowning man. If a if the best surgeon is suffering from a terrible cancerous disease, does he have the capacity to perform surgery on another? Huh? He has to go to a surgeon and be healed, and then he has the power and the strength to heal others. That's what it means, physician, heal thyself. If we equip ourselves with purity, morality, and spiritual consciousness, then we can give that to others. And that is what really the soul is longing to do, to connect with Krishna and connect others to Krishna. So the name of God is that medicine which can connect all living beings, irregardless of whatever condition in society they are presently dwelling, whether they are in the bodies of a man or a woman, whether they are of upper class or lower class, upper caste or so-called lower caste. These temporary designations are utterly irrelevant to the soul. As irrelevant as one person is driving a Maruti, one person is driving a Ambassador, one person a Contessa, one person a Mercedes, one person a Rolls Royce. But the real consideration is the person inside. The person inside is suffering terribly from arthritis, rheumatism, and what joy is his Rolls Royce or Mercedes Benz going to give him? Huh? We see people with great healthy bodies utterly miserable, lonely, frustrated in life, agitated, no fulfillment. But the name of God is a medicine which works on every living being if they take it properly. Why? Because it is medicine for the soul. It awakens the soul from its sleeping condition. I'd like to read a letter, if I can find it. Malati. Malati has AIDS. Somehow or other, years ago, she contracted it. And someone recently gave her some herbal remedy that they claimed would heal AIDS, would cure AIDS. So, to please the people giving, she took it. It's a long letter, but I'll just read one part. She says that she has faithfully consumed the particular medicines. She said, by the persistent mercy of Jamuna Prabhu, who was making all of these preparations for her every day, she says, but I admit to small faith in this medicine. I only fully trust in Srila Prabhupada's prescription. He said this Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, is the only medicine I have. So won't you please take it? This is what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada is our doctor. Prabhupada told her, she was Prabhupada's personal cook for many years. She said, Prabhupada said, this Maha Mantra is the only medicine I have, so won't you please take it? Unquote. So my real desire is to increase consumption of this remedy. I beg your merciful assistance to this end. She may have AIDS, but AIDS means you're going to die, but you're going to die whether you have AIDS or not. So in one sense, we all have that disease. We all have a terminal disease. The terminal disease is this material body. It's guaranteed that it will terminate. And there's only one medicine for that terminal disease, and that is the name of God. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
So, we want to be real servants of society to the maximum capacity, to be doctors of the body, mind, and soul. And in the college, you are learning something that will be useful. But Vishwarup and Devamrit and Gauranga, who comes? What they are giving is something hundreds, millions, billions, trillions, quadrillions of times more valuable than anything in a college. They are giving you the medicine to cure the repetition of birth and death, to liberate the soul from the prison of the threefold miseries of material existence. The medicine that can bring about a revolution of consciousness that can awaken your original blissful nature. So my humble request is you're all intelligent, young, cultured men and ladies, that the world needs you. The world needs not good physical doctors. The world needs compassionate people who are willing to reveal the truth to society. That is the greatest need. And Krishna is calling upon each and every one of you to dedicate your life to whatever degree for that purpose. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
So all of you can ask questions, Maharaj. That the name of God is the only medicine for stopping repetition of birth and death.
Krishna says.
Yes. But none of us have seen those people who have left and where they have gone and what they feel like after leaving this body. Does this medicine help them? And did it help them at the moment of death? Or what happened to them? We are just speaking amongst people who are living, and we have some experiences of pleasure chanting of Hare Krishna. But when it comes to moment of death, and what we call as change of body and future life and all, what is the proof? We want to know that, is there any proof that people are dead, where they have gone? Anybody seen them?
Yes. Maybe you have not seen. What is the proof? First of all, we can understand that any medicine will have its greatest effect when it's taken according to prescription. If a person takes medicine whimsically, it will not have the same effect. If someone has a disease, some serious infection, then you tell him, here is an antibiotic. You take one every morning, one every evening for the next 10 days. And that person takes one, and then 2 weeks later he takes another, and 4 days later he takes another. Will there be much effect? Minimal. Medicine must be taken according to prescription. And that is why we need a spiritual master. We can't just whimsically chant God's name according to our own idea. We need to live a particular life and take the medicine of the name in such a way that it will have a maximum effect. That is the prescription. And those who actually follow sincerely in this way, we can see within their life, if they're seriously taking it properly, that there is great transformation. They become less greedy. They become less selfish. They become more moral. They become more content. They become more compassionate. And the most compassionate people that ever lived on the face of this earth, historically, are those people who dedicated their lives to God. Not the politicians, not the scientists, but the people who were truly saintly, who appear truly purified by God and His name, that we can see. And we can see the transformation of people's lives when they start to take to spiritual life and chant the name of God. That we can see. Remarkable transformations. Historically as well as in the present moment. Exactly where the soul goes at the time of death, you do not have the power to see that in the conditioned state of consciousness. But all these great acharyas, all these great saintly teachers, all these great scriptures, which are the most highest manifestation of science, ancient sciences, are explaining this principle. There are many things you have to accept on the basis of reasonable, philosophical, scientific faith that simply your senses have no access to perceive. But these scriptures have transformed the lives of so many others, and the greatest persons that ever lived believe in them. And why cannot God, the Creator, the supreme origin of everything that exists, reveal the truth, which He has through so many incarnations? When you study medicine, you have practically no realization or perception of anything at the beginning of the study. You just accept it on the basis of faith. And gradually, as you progress, you develop realization that it's true. Correct? At first, it's all theoretical. Through practicing, there's realization. So similarly, as we practice Krishna consciousness with faith, gradually, even in this life, we realize the eternal nature and the deathlessness of the soul. And we become free and fearless. Does that answer your question?
No, I'm not yet convinced about that. Those people who have left his bodies, who are supposed to be devotees, they have not meant them to hear the experience exactly. What happened to them? We have seen doctors.
I already explained. You cannot. Because of your incapability. Because of your conditioned nature. Why can you not see? Because we are so much identifying with this gross body. We only see gross bodies. We do not have the intuitive development to perceive what is beyond this body. Because our whole reality is this body. As we come to a subtler spiritual platform, we can perceive the true effects and the true progress of the soul. But all the great authorities have told us this. And if we just practice Krishna consciousness, gradually we have direct experience of the same thing. At the beginning of medical science, do you know about medicine? The beginning is you accept authority and you follow them. And then realization and experience comes of how medicines work and how diseases are cured. The first day you're in school, do you know? So I'm saying the same thing. You may not be able to perceive the eternal nature of the soul now. But if you accept the proper authority and follow that proper authority, you will gradually realize and experience it, definitely. But not any authority, proper authority. If you want to study medicine, you don't study from any quack who says, I'm a doctor and I will teach you. You go to that professor who has been in a line, who has learned from other professors and was teaching according to the standard books. Correct? He's certified. He studied the proper books. He studied under the proper professors. He can teach me. He's authorized. In the same way, if we want to understand spiritual science, Not anyone who has a shaved head or long hair. Not anyone who just knows how to fast or can perform magic tricks is a proper teacher. A guru is one who has studied the proper books, the proper scriptures, who has learned them from proper authorities, and who lives and teaches accordingly. That is called disciplic succession. Teachers, professors in college come in disciplic succession also. They graduated from a certain college. They learned from someone who graduated from another college. They learned from someone who graduated from another college. Isn't that the standard way of learning medicine? That's also the standard way of learning spiritual knowledge. And as we study from proper authority, we get realization, we get experience. Then we can directly perceive these things. Until then, through philosophical conviction, through basic common sense, and through submissive hearing from self-realized souls of the past and present, we believe in these things. Gradually the realization comes as we practice. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the soul cannot be perceived with our senses, but the symptom of the presence of the soul can be perceived, and that is life. The symptom of the presence of the soul is consciousness, or life, that we can perceive, but the soul cannot. It is said that the soul is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. How can you see it with your eyes? How can you see where it's going after it leaves this body? But Krishna explains, one who thinks of me at the time of death attains me without fail. Is there any other questions?
Yes. In our normal life, it's very difficult for us to practice Krishna consciousness according to the prescribed rules. According to the rules we are told how to go through. Because we are very weak at this very stage. Mm-hmm. We have just come into it. I mean, we have just, we can say, jumped into it. Because we are just, we are very juvenile to start with it. And we do commit blunders simultaneously. But is it that if we don't leave it and just have faith in it, and even if we are doing blunders, we don't see towards the blunders, is it that our blunders will go off sometime and we'll be able to overcome? Because at present what I feel is that I'm not able to overcome, even though I'm knowing that these things are blunders which I'm committing, but I'm still not able to overcome. And is it that we'll be able to overcome that in case we continue this?
Most definitely. When a baby child tries to walk, he doesn't start running his first attempt because his legs are weak. First time he tries, he falls. Second time, he stands a little longer, but then he falls. Third time, slightly longer, and falls. Correct? But because he keeps trying, every time he tries, every time he endeavors, he gets more strength. And soon, he never falls. Walking is completely natural. Running is completely natural. So in the same way, when we begin our spiritual lives, we should know that there are certain gross activities that we should very strictly avoid. We should not fall. Most of us do have the power to restrain those illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, meat eating. But as far as the mind, still inclined toward materialistic activities, our mind is still very spiritually weak. And from time time to time it's following. It's going after some sense object. It's going after some greed or some lust or some envy or some pride. Yes? This is what you're saying?
Yeah.
But if we keep practicing, if we don't give up, if we keep trying, if we keep resisting to our capacity these temptations, if we keep chanting God's name, if we keep associating with proper people, if we keep hearing proper philosophy, engaging in proper seva, we become little by little more strong. Our mind becomes stronger, our senses become stronger, spiritually stronger. But it takes time. We're like babies learning to walk spiritually. And through constant practice and determination, gradually we become very strong. Then our mind becomes our best friend.
So we sometimes don't even want to. We don't even want to leave it. Although we know that it is wrong, but we don't want to leave it. And the other thing is that even if we know that Mahamantra is very strong medicine which we are taking, even if we chant Mahamantra, still we are not able to overcome, then one feels very helpless that no, you are still not able to overcome this pride or this lust or whatsoever, such kind of things. And then seems as if no, it's not that strong. And it's not able to make me overcome such things. Then it means it's not that strong, if you put it logically.
As a doctor, if somebody has had a disease 40 years and has completely neglected that disease for all 40 years, and he comes to you for treatment, and you give him medicine, you give him a diet, you give him particular exercise, and after 2 days he says, I'm not better. What's wrong with this medicine? What's wrong with your prescription? What will you tell him? That you've been neglecting this disease for 40 years. It takes more than 2 days to become healed. The desires that we have in our hearts and in our minds, we have been cultivating perhaps for many, many births. Not to speak of this life, so many previous. We just take to Krishna consciousness. How long have you been chanting? How long have you been associating with devotees? A few months? How long?
3 months.
You've been serving Maya for 8,400,000 births. And you have been assimilating, imbibing the contaminations of the disease of Maya for 8 million births. And you've been taking the holy name minimally for 3 months. And you expect to be a liberated soul? It takes time, but the medicine does work. Gradually, I think if you examine your values in life in the last 3 months, you'll see a remarkable difference of what you held precious as far as morality and a goal of life between now and 3 months ago. I believe there's a drastic transformation in your way of thinking. So much has been done in 3 months to change your consciousness, your whole direction of life. Continue on.
Sir, I've got a personal question. Sir, like, I'm not able to come up for the temple every Sunday. Or I'm like, I feel that I have still to devote more, because I'm not very disciplined regarding my studies. As I feel that I have to devote more time towards my studies. And if I chant in my room itself, it will be sufficient enough for me. So is it right?
If you actually, genuinely, honestly do not have time, yes, it is right. But if you do have time, it's very important, in addition to your chanting in your room alone, to come and to associate with wonderful devotees. It gives a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and faith to continue the process. If you cannot, Krishna will certainly give you everything right in your room. But if you can, then he's waiting to give it to you here also. You should come and accept it. Both are required.
And friends.
Thank you very much.
Prabhu, now there is one practical problem which I am facing. You know, the thing is that I come on Sundays, and even whenever I get chance, I come, I get the opportunity, get my fortune is with me, I come over here, listen to the devotees. The thing is, if you say that hearing of pure ideas, God name, and just studying, reading of Bhagavadam are good ideas, it's not enough. We should understand the thing by proper guru, by proper devotee of Lord Krishna. Suppose somebody comes on Sunday and the practical problem is there is communication there. He or she doesn't understand the language in which the understanding of Bhagavatam is being given at that time. Suppose my mother wants to come on Sunday. I say that my mother, please come over there, there is great joy. You get the understanding of everything, you get the knowledge of God. Just study, she used to study scriptures and all that since 20, 25, 30 years. I say that please come over there, and she asks it. Udhar to sab English mein hoga. So means because the ideas should be given by proper guru and hearing of that proper. Suppose I tell her that my guru has said this thing, but it doesn't make that much of effect. And my intelligence was not at that level that I can make her understand everything about that much extent. So how this practical problem is overcome?
What language does she speak?
Hindi. And
most,
every time they
most of the lectures here are in Hindi.
But on Sundays, actually it's a Prabhu. Every time on Sunday there is a facility of transfer, means there is a translation of that lecture in Hindi.
And the best, you see, if someone is translating exactly what that person says, and she's hearing from that person through sound vibration. What many devotees do here, and what you can do for your mother, is you see these ladies here? Vishaka, Kishori, Sangeeta, Pinky, Meera. They all know English, Hindi very nice. They can sit next to your mother, and as if the person is speaking English, as he's talking, they could translate perfectly. And she could understand every part of the lecture.
I let her know about that thing.
Isn't that what you do with your mother, Kishori? Her mother also doesn't know English. But when she comes to the temple, her daughter just translates in her ear as it's being spoken. In fact, there are brahmacharis in this temple who speak no English. But because they're anxious to hear, somebody's always translating as I'm speaking or as whoever is speaking, and they hear everything.
Yes,
very nice.
This thing that they can translate. I tell my mother that it's a great opportunity to her to come over there, because I can understand, so I can come and get the nectar.
We can arrange, because it might not look so nice for you to be on the lady side translating. No. We can arrange these ladies, they can do that service. They'll be happy to. They'll be joyful to.
This is our opportunity of the whole.
You come on Sundays? What you should do is when you come on Sunday, just introduce your mother to Vishwaroop Prabhu, and he'll arrange one of these nice lady devotees to translate for her. And then she'll hear every word of it.
Maharaj, generally, don't you think that justice delayed is justice denied? We see that suppose there is a prisoner, and the prisoner has committed some sin, and the prisoner has committed some grave crime. Then suddenly the prisoner has gone into unconsciousness. And then at that time, the prisoner is given the punishment which actually he deserves. Then in another case, suppose the prisoner is allowed to come out of that unconsciousness and then remain conscious, and then he is given that punishment. Then don't you think that if the prisoner is given the punishment in a conscious state in which he is able to appreciate that I am being punished in this way for this crime that I have done, then he would be able to
remedy himself, or he will be able to correct himself from the in the future. But if actually the prisoner has done some crime and then he is punished, when he is in an unconscious state, when he is actually not able to appreciate that I am being punished for this, then don't you think that punishment has gone a waste? In the case of the soul, we see that a soul does many kinds of crimes or misdeeds in a particular life. Then after that, in that life, in many cases, in some cases it is punished, but in many cases the soul is not punished in that life. And then when the soul takes another life, then we see that the soul is punished for the misdeeds which the soul had committed in the previous body. For example, in this life only, we come across many instances. For example, even in my native place, there was a pujari. Now the pujari, he was completely, he used to do worship of God and in this way he used to earn his livelihood. And he was a man who was completely in a mode of goodness. Means to no one he would ever be unkind, or to no one he would ever be unsympathetic. Always, whoever persons have come across, used to come across that pujari, he always used to be in a state of goodness. Now, I don't know whether he was transcendental or not, but he always used to be in a state of goodness. But then what happened when he died, we saw that such a play of circumstances came into being that he had to die of starvation. Now in this case, we see that even though the person, we might tell that yes, he has got the punishment of the misdeeds which he had done in the past. But then don't you think that if suppose in this life only I am being punished, I think that I get bewildered, I get frustrated. But suppose if I would have got punished for my misdeeds in my previous life itself, then I would have had this strong belief that yes, I should correct my deeds in the future. Otherwise, if I get punished in this life, I don't remember anything about my past life. I am now completely unconscious regarding my past life. So even if I am being punished, I am not able to be in a condition to appreciate that I am being punished for the misdeeds in the past. Because generally I don't have this belief of my past life. I don't have the belief whether I had any past life or I will be having any future life or not. So this punishment, is don't you think it is going a waste? Don't you think justice delayed is justice denied?
Anyone like to answer that question?
Should I like to
answer? The first thing is, you think and I think. But we do not know what is best. You may think and have your opinion, and I may have my opinion, and God has his opinion. Who knows better? You, me, or God? Who knows more about the machine? The manufacturer, or the person who's just been using it for a short time? God has created everything. He has created the material nature. He has created all of the phenomena within material nature. He has created the soul. He's created all the situations in which the soul passes through. And his whole material creation is meant to ultimately cleanse the soul of the disease of ignorance and forgetfulness. And everything that's happening in this material creation is for that purpose. Now, does God know better how to serve justice, or do you and me know better? You may think that this is the best way for the soul to learn, but God knows something else. That is the first point. Second point is, on a more relative level, that people are suffering in this world and they're still not giving up their sins because they simply are too attached, even though they know it. People smoke cigarettes and they know it will kill them, but they won't give it up, even though they see the sign that this is going to kill you. They still can't give it up because they're too attached. And that's the same type of attachment that practically everyone has in this world for materialistic karmic activities. Because they're too attached. Therefore, let us use an example of the medical profession. If a person wants to know why he's suffering, he'll understand in principle, and that's all he needs to know. He doesn't need to know the specifics. And if a person does not want to know, then however much you tell him, he won't listen. Do you understand what I'm saying? Suppose a person is suffering from sinful activities. If he really wants to understand why I'm suffering and how I can get out of it, he'll hear what is the principle. He doesn't need the specifics, what he did and when. He'll just understand the principle which is being affected on him, and he'll give up his sins. And he'll take to a pure life, a holy life. Correct? Because he wants to know. But if a person doesn't want to know, even if he reads it and hears it and is preached to it, he won't listen. He won't change. God has given scripture in every part of the world. And there are preachers in every part of the world. Everyone knows what is morality and what is immorality. Huh? Everyone knows what is spiritual life and what is material life. Everyone knows what is sin and what isn't sin. But why the world is in such a chaos? Because they don't want to hear. They're too attached. And if you don't want to hear, God will not force you to hear. He'll let you go through the evolution of suffering until you finally do want to hear and understand why. God's telling you why. But do you want to hear it? Do you want to follow? Do you want to understand? If you do, he will speak through his representatives. He will send someone if they want to know. And if you don't want to know, he won't force you. He'll let you go on suffering until you want to know. And I was bringing it to the medical idea. If a person has malaria, and he's suffering, fever, nausea, whatever other symptoms there are, and a doctor comes and says, you have malaria, here's the medicine, take it and be cured. Is there any doubt whether the person has malaria? But what if the person asks, I'll take this medicine if you tell me which mosquito bit me? I want to know which mosquito. I want to see that mosquito. And I want to know exactly what date and what time and where. Does it matter? Does it matter where you got bit, when you got bit, or which mosquito bit you? You know in principle that somewhere, sometime, some mosquito bit me, and I have the disease, so let me take the medicine. All you have to know is the principle. So similarly, we're suffering. And we know that suffering is due to bad karma. We don't have to know exactly where or when or how we did it. We know in principle, we did it. So we should stop doing it. And we should take the medicine to cleanse ourselves of the reactions of it. That is intelligence. And if you want to know, you'll accept it on that principle and you'll take the medicine. And if you don't want to know, you'll make so many excuses. I won't take it unless you tell me exactly when, where, and how, because justice delayed is justice denied. It's a justification to go on in ignorance.
But Maharaj, in this case, we see generally in the case of malaria.
As far as the pujari goes, if he was actually genuinely a holy man, whether he died of starvation, whether he died of malaria, or whether he died of old age, if he was a holy man, he was gratefully thinking of God at the time of his death, and his life was perfect. It's not so important how we die physically. It's important how we die consciously. And if he was such a good person, God would have been there at the time of his death to take him away, to take him to the perfection of life, or at least to elevate him. If he didn't mind, why should you mind?
Maharaj, don't you think this gives a very, very bad impression on us? We don't know what is God or what is God.
It gives a bad impression if you want to see bad impressions. It doesn't give bad impressions to the rest of us. We see that if he was God conscious, however he dies, it's glorious. He's perfected his life. It gives bad impressions to those who want to remain in ignorance. It gives them an excuse. Just see! Just see! He's a religious man and he starved. Therefore, I can do anything I like. Because justice denied is justice delayed is justice denied. Justice is not delayed. It's given like medicine, in doses by material energy, according to what will best sober you up from your material intoxication and illusion.
Maharaj, I'd like to ask one question. That is, in this
one
case,
question?
As you gave the example of malaria, alright, it's alright, but actually if we consider this analogy to the actual life, we see that in this case, the person is suffering from malaria, but he has accepted it as a part of this life, and he refuses to believe that this malaria has been caused by the bite of a mosquito. He is telling that, no, I've just got this malaria, everyone is getting this malaria. There is no person in this world who is not having this malaria, so why to be angry at this malaria? And then the drug which you are giving, how to believe that this drug is going to cure me? First show me that this malaria has really, this mosquito has really bitten me, and show me the parasites which have caused this malaria in the stomach of this mosquito. Then I am going to believe that I am having this malaria. Otherwise I believe that no, it's a general thing, everyone is having this malaria. Why to believe that your drug only has the potency to cure this malaria? In that case, don't you think it is extremely essential to show the person the mosquito and to demonstrate the plasmodia which had caused that malaria in the stomach of that mosquito?
How many people demanded such a service from a doctor? Have you ever met anyone?
Yeah, we are seeing that.
Have you ever met anyone who would not take the medicine until they saw the stomach of the mosquito that bit them?
That is because, Maharaj, they have full faith on us.
If you want to become cleansed of your spiritual disease, you have to have full faith in Krishna, the ultimate doctor, and his representatives. Otherwise, there's no possibility.
But as Vishnu Prabhu already told, in that case, the patient can see the other patients getting all right by the doctor, getting cured by the doctor. But in this case, we have no direct access of seeing whether the soul is actually going to the spiritual world or what is happening. We don't have any direct access of seeing.
You can see transformations of values in people's lives.
That is only to the mode of goodness.
Transformation, no. We see people who previously were doing all kinds of watching television, going to cinemas, now they're coming to the temple to chant God's name in joy. We can see that. Or as Prabhupada used to tell us in America, we can see hippies becoming happies. We can see people who were lost who have found the goal and purpose of life. That we can see with our own eyes. And that should give us faith.
But Maharaj, don't you think that in this people, in this world, people accept sufferings just because they think that sufferings are a part of life? Sufferings are an inevitable part of life. So why not at least enjoy the enjoyments that are present on this world? If a person derives enjoyment in drinking alcohol, or if a person derives enjoyment in doing other some kind of other, suppose some other lusty activity.
This is ignorance. Therefore, religion without philosophy is sentiment of fanaticism. We have to have philosophical conviction. Are you the body or are you the soul? At the time of death, every part of your body is present, but where are you? Who is it that's speaking through your mouth and seeing through your eyes and thinking through your brain and loving through your heart and feeling through your flesh? Who is it? It's not the flesh that's feeling. It's not the eyes that are seeing. It's not the brain that's thinking. There's a person, there's a consciousness within. And when that conscious force leaves the body, the brain, the eyes, the flesh, everything's there. But there's no conscious witness because the person is gone. We are not this body. We are the eternal soul. We must understand what are the needs of the soul. What is the nature of the soul? That is philosophy. And that is what human life is meant for, to use our developed intelligence to understand these things and to discriminate between truth and illusion. People who want to remain in ignorance, who have no proper philosophy of life, who have no conception of the difference between matter and spirit, yes, eat, sleep, enjoy, be merry, because tomorrow may never come. And people who want to remain in ignorance propagate this philosophy and even try to defeat real philosophy to justify their attachments. And there is a saying. What is that saying? If a person doesn't want to hear, you cannot convince him of anything.
You can wake up the person who is sleeping, who is pretending to sleep.
One convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. That is what I was thinking. One convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. We can preach philosophy to someone. But if he doesn't want to hear, if he has no submission to the truth, there'll be no change in his heart, no change in his mind. And therefore, for such people, God is a God of love. He wants love from people. He will not force us. If you want to remain in ignorance, he'll allow you to remain in ignorance. But eventually, just through your own experiences of suffering, you will turn to him. In your time, you will turn to him. The question is, why not now? Why should we waste our valuable, precious time? Krishna knows that eventually every living being is going to turn to him and surrender to him when they decide by their free will out of love. But as long as you want to maintain all of these ideas, concepts, and justifications, he will allow you to go on like that. Birth after birth after birth. Why not now? We have the chance. We have the golden opportunity to perfect our lives and bring real joy to the world. Take it.
Every person, you told that there are many people who actually don't want to come out of this ignorance. But they will only want to come out of this ignorance only when they realize that they are really in ignorance. But then we see, suppose we have come in contact with devotees, but there are so many millions and millions of people in this world who are actually involved completely in the mode of ignorance, but there is no one actually to tell them that you are in the mode of ignorance.
That is not true. If they really want to know Krishna's in their heart, he will direct them to someone who will tell.
But they would want to come out of this ignorance.
And another thing, if you're feeling such a concern, why don't you become a preacher and do something for these people? It's like if people are suffering the plague in the earthquake zone and you're a doctor and you're sitting in Bombay saying, there's nobody to help them. What good is that talk? You should go and help them. If you know there's so many people suffering due to ignorance and there's nobody to tell them, you should go out and tell them. That's what all of us have decided. We should go out and tell them. There's a great need. There's an epidemic. And there's a need for a lot of spiritual doctors. And we're trying to recruit more and more. Not for ourselves, but for the suffering people.
Maharaj, I would like to ask one question which I had faced during while trying to preach to one of my classmates. Maharaj, actually, I told him about the basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and he told that, see, whatever you are telling, everything is actually based on what Srila Prabhupada had told. Even the Gita that you are studying, that actually has shlokas in Sanskrit. Now, you don't know anything about Sanskrit, even I don't know anything about Sanskrit. So, what is actually the meaning of these shlokas, we don't know. We only know whatever the translation we are reading from these shlokas. But then again, these translations have been done by Srila Prabhupada. So, ultimately, whatever convictions, you may tell that we don't speak anything by our heads. We speak only what has been given in the scriptures. But then again, the scriptures, we don't have the access to understand them directly in Sanskrit. So we have to take the help of somebody who is translating it. So again, here comes the credibility of the person who is actually translating these shlokas to English. So how to believe that whatever Srila Prabhupada is telling, or in whichever way he has translated the Gita or the Bhagavatam, it is actually right? How to believe that whatever
even
he is
if telling, you know Sanskrit perfectly, that doesn't make any difference. Because you cannot understand the scriptures by knowing Sanskrit. Tad vijnanartham sukurum eva avigashya. You can only understand the scriptures by hearing at the feet of the great souls. Upanishad means to sit at the feet of the great souls. Asmad gurum prabhagyeta jagyasu sreyutam. It is the only way the Vedas could be understood. There are thousands of Sanskrit scholars in India who know nothing about the conclusion of the Vedas. Only those who hear from the proper disciplic succession can understand the real essence and truth. Now, Krishna does say, and any Sanskrit scholar will tell you, that Krishna says, Vedaishta sarveya aham eva vedyo vedantikrit veda vedeva cha. Even the most materialistic, atheistic Sanskrit scholar will tell you that this set means, Krishna says, by all the Vedas I am to be known. And he also says, sarva dharman parityaja mamekam sharanam raja. Any Sanskrit scholar will tell you that Krishna is saying, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. And Krishna also says, matta parataram nanyat kinchid asti dhananjayat. Any Sanskrit scholar who will literally translate will tell you that this means that there is no truth superior to Krishna. And Krishna says, man mana bhava man bhakto. Any Sanskrit scholar will tell you this means always think of Krishna, become his devotee, you will come to Krishna. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravartate. Every Sanskrit scholar will tell you that this means, aham means me, Krishna. It means that Krishna is the source of everything that exists. Everything is emanating from him, and the wise who know this perfectly engage in his loving service. Now, aren't these slokas transparent and self-evident that it means we're supposed to surrender to Krishna? But the problem is, practically every other translator says, this is what the Sanskrit says, but this is what it means. And then they give their own idea. Man manabhava madbhakto madhyajimna namaskuru. Krishna says, always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, offer your homage to me. In this way you will come to me without fail. Everyone will translate it the same way. It has to be. It's Sanskrit. But the most popular commentary of the Bhagavad Gita, who used to be the president of India, one of the greatest scholars, in his purport, translation is perfect, but his purport will say, says, when Krishna says me, he doesn't mean him, Krishna, the personality. He means the unborn, unmanifest, invisible, impersonal within himself. Now, if Krishna wanted us to surrender to the unborn, impersonal, invisible within himself, why didn't he say that? He said, me. So Prabhupada says, when Krishna says me, that means Krishna. And another translator says, Krishna says, bhaktya mam abhijanati yavan yashtashmitatva. Krishna says, only by bhakti, only devotion, I can be known in truth. Everyone has to translate it that way. Bhaktya means bhakti, devotion. And there is commentators I have seen, they say that devotion means meditation on the impersonal within Krishna. Why didn't Krishna say it? Prabhupada says, Krishna says, bhaktya mam, that means devotion to him. And who's him? Krishna. That's why it's called Bhagavad Gita as it is. When Krishna says, surrender to me, Prabhupada says, surrender to Krishna. And other commentators are saying, that's not what it means. It says that, but it's not what it means. It means something else. You are Krishna. It means surrender to yourself. But Krishna says, mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta shanatana. That all living beings are my part and parcels. They are eternally my servants. They are eternally subordinate to me. That's what he says. Surrender to Krishna means surrender to Krishna. When Arjuna was told to surrender to Krishna, did he surrender to himself or did he surrender to Krishna? So even from the point of view of Sanskrit, if you study the translation, you'll find that Prabhupada is simply speaking what Krishna is saying. But he's just revealing it. It's obvious. What's the most obvious is hidden. Tadvedi pranipatinam pariprasnena sevya. What's most obvious cannot be understood except through the transparent via medium. Just like you're obviously sitting here, but Vishwarupa cannot see without his glasses because he has defective vision. His glasses are not showing something new. They're just revealing what's there. But if you put on red-colored glasses, or yellow-colored glasses, or orange-colored glasses, or black-colored glasses, you don't see what's really there. So many commentators are giving various colored glasses. Prabhupada is giving the clear, transparent vision of what Krishna is saying. And when you hear him, you know it's true, just by understanding the Sanskrit. And even if you don't know in the Sanskrit, just if you see any translation, you'll see that what Prabhupada's saying is what Krishna means, and what others are saying is something else. And another thing is, what Prabhupada's saying is not his own opinion. It is what he has heard from his guru. Who heard from his guru? Who heard from his guru? In a disciplic succession, and we read the histories and the glories of such persons, and we see the example of Prabhupada's personal life, and we understand that this is a disciplic succession of self-realized, liberated souls. And he's simply repeating, like a postman, the eternal message, without adding or subtracting anything. Therefore, we have faith in his words. He's not just an upstart giving his own opinion. He's presenting what he has heard. And Gita says, evam parampara praptam. The only way to understand Gita is hearing from someone in such a disciplic succession, who is purely, with all humility, delivering the message. And that you can understand with a little sincerity is what Prabhupada has done. Just one more. This is Om Purnamada Purnima. The one is full of variety. This is Vaishnava philosophy. That the one is full of variegatedness.
We generally in the Krishna conscious philosophy we tell that the Vedas came into being even before this creation, material creation came into being. Maharaj, do we have any direct proof to assess that actually the Vedas that has been transferred to all these generations, even through millions and millions of years, it has not actually been distorted? Its meaning has actually not been distorted, or it has not actually been written by the Aryans of the early Vedic period who had come here from the region of Iran and Mesopotamia and settled here, according to what the historians tell. Is there any direct proof to negate this statement of the historians?
Do they have any direct proof?
Yeah, they have all the remains of the Harappa culture and the Mohenjo-daro culture. They have found out through excavations the different their level of
no doubt they have remains of those cultures.
Lotus and
but they have lotus. Yes, we admit they have lotus that they have found in the ground. But how does that connect to them writing the Vedas? They have some
manuscripts.
They have some archaeological proofs that a culture existed.
Yeah. And which but wrote down this the Vedas.
Wrote down, but what is the evidence? It wasn't there already. There's no evidence. The rest is speculation. First of all, you have to understand that these historians who came and who created this whole Aryan idea were Christian missionaries who came from the Western countries for only one purpose: to convert the Hindus into Christians.
But Maharaj, at that time Christianity had not come into being. That is, during the early Vedic period, at that time Christianity had not come into being.
The whole concept you're talking about was created by the Christians.
I'm talking about 5000 BC.
I'm talking about the people who tell you all these things about 5000 BC. The historians are not the people that lived in 5000 BC. The historians are the Christian missionaries who came to India to convert you to Christianity by showing that your religion is inferior to theirs. That's who created this whole concept of the Aryans and the Vedas being created by people coming from Iran. And because the British Indologists and the German Indologists came and they actually learned Sanskrit and they actually tried to prove things in this way, and India was subjugated by British rule, this became standard government-approved knowledge. It was a very, very terrible and massive form of brainwashing people by degrading their faith in their religion. And it was done very systematically. And now even Hindus believe this nonsense. It's unfortunate. They have no evidence. They have no proof. They take some evidence that they do have, and then they make a big show of what they found, and then they connect it to something through word jugglery and speculation and say this is a fact. Darwin's theory of evolution is the same nonsense. He found some fossils, and he found some other fossils, and then he created a whole theory of how they're all connected, which disproves the existence of God. But there's no reality to anything he said, and foolish people believe it. So there are so many theories. This is nothing but a blind theory. But the people who know the Vedas are the people who follow the Vedas. Not the ill-motivated historians who just comment totally theoretically. The people who know the Vedas are the saints, the sages, the rishis that have been following since time immemorial and who have given their lives to those teachings and who have realized enlightenment and pure devotion through that. They are the people we understand the Vedas from.
But Maharaj, again we haven't really met these saints, rishis and these great scholars. We again come to know about them through history only or through the Vedas.
Which history are you going to believe? That is your question. The history of those faithful people living according to high principles, morality, dedication, and compassion, or the history of people who are ill-motivated and very, very much have their own agenda and are not living pure lives at all. That is your choice. Whose history do you want? What do you want to become like?
Maharaj, you told that at that time the indologists, they propagated this these views just to negate our own Vedic cultures. But Maharaj, at present the historians within the history books which we are studying at present, they are not actually coming from the indologists. They
yes,
are actually
they
coming
are.
From the Indian historians
who
are...
No, you are wrong. They're coming from the Indian historians who have been totally brainwashed by the educational systems of the British. They're not coming from the people who go to ashrams and learn from the people who really deeply understand and believe in the Vedas. These same people will say that the Vedas are mythology. There's nothing true about them. And they'll say the same thing about the Muslim faith. They have all their proofs to convert the Muslims to Christianity too. This is all nonsense.
Maharaj, we say that the Darwin's theory that actually is completely nonsense.
If you want to know, you follow. If you want to know, you follow Bhagavad Gita and you see what it does to your life. Then you don't have to guess whether these missionary historians are speaking the truth or not. You will know. If you taste sugar and someone tells you that it's sour, you know that it's not. And these devotees have tasted what is Bhagavad Gita. They're getting realizations. They understand to various levels what is truth.
Maharaj, then do you think that Bible and Quran, what it is written in that is of no value?
It is of value. We consider them literatures which are, according to time and circumstance, presenting Sanatana Dharma, the same truths that are in the Vedas. No person who understands the Vedic knowledge will deny any of these scriptures because they see the same thing is there to a particular proportion according to the time and circumstance. The Vedas are like an encyclopedia. They include everything. If you're in a PhD course and someone comes with a high school textbook, do you say it's bogus? No, you'll say it's very good. It's very good. It may not include everything that is in your book, but you know that the same message is there and it's leading to the same goal.
But many things Indian mythology, they are unbelievable, like many things, like Hanuman wanted to swallow the whole sun. So, why should it be?
It's unbelievable to persons who are brainwashed by material energy to think that what they can do is all that anyone can do.
But many other things.
Let me ask you this. You have seen little ants on the ground? How much can an ant lift?
10 times greater weight.
But what is that? 1 milligram? What? Something like that. Maybe you can lift 1 milligram. Or maybe 1 centigram or whatever they're called. How much could you lift? You could lift probably 100 pounds. Is there any ant on earth that could lift 100 pounds?
But
many other examples.
No, I'm asking you. Now, ants cannot comprehend what you're doing. They do not have the intelligence to comprehend what a human being is. Why? Because they're ants. They have the brain of an ant. They have the consciousness of an ant. All they can relate to is being an ant. If one ant were to tell another ant that I saw, what is your name?
Rajesh.
That I saw someone named Rajesh. He lifted 100 pounds. That ant would say, forget it, mythology. Why? Because he's thinking in terms of an ant. So you're just a tiny little human being. The ant is thinking that there's no one greater than ants. But the human being is, we're all thinking we're the greatest, we're so good. I can't swallow the sun, so how can anyone swallow the sun? But there are beings greater than you and me. We're like ants next to such great souls as Hanuman. And with our ant-like consciousness, we cannot understand what they're doing.
Other examples are also there, like Earth.
But if you get out of your ant-like consciousness, you understand that there is greater beings than you. It's not that just because other humans who are just like us can't do it, that nobody could do it. There are more powerful beings than ourselves. Millions of times, trillions of times more powerful. Why is that so hard to believe? Because we're like ants. We're so conditioned that we are the only reality.
Other example?
Krishna. The earth is placed on snake's hood. Krishna. What is that?
What is it?
It is said that earth is placed on...
You just said what it is.
Earth is placed on snake's hood, Krishna. Which is the resting place of Vishnu.
Doesn't say the earth. It says the universe. Nowhere does it say that the earth is on a snake's foot. No scripture. It says the universe. Now, we can see what it says in the scripture that the earth is floating in the sky. It says that. But with our telescopes, can we see what's beyond this universe to see whether it's on a snake's foot or not? Huh? What is so impossible? The God who created this whole universe, he cannot create a snake's hood to rest it on? Is that so difficult to believe? It is if you think that God is just like you. If you think God, maybe I can lift 100 pounds, maybe God could lift 120. But no, not more than that. It's not possible. Is that your consciousness? That is not... perception of truth. You are infinitesimal. God is infinite. God could do anything. If you could create this earth planet and Mars and Venus and Saturn and all the sun and all of this universe and make everything working so systematically and scientifically in such perfect order, if you could create that, you couldn't create a snake to hold it? Huh? For us, it's absolutely believable. Whatever the scripture says God's done is totally believable. Just like, I won't tell the whole story, but Narada Muni was asked by one very proud Brahmin, when you saw Narayan, what was he doing? He said, Narayan told me to tell you that he was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. And the Brahmin said, that's ridiculous nonsense. How could anyone put an elephant through the eye of a needle? So Narada left thinking, such kind of Brahmins, what is this world coming to? And then he came to a little cobbler, Sudra, a Shudra cobbler. And that cobbler said, oh, you have gone to see Narayan? What was he doing? He said he was putting an elephant through an eye of a needle.
That's what Narayan told me to tell you. He said, oh, how wonderful. And Narada Rishi said, you believe me? You believe me that he was actually putting an elephant through the eye of a needle? He said, of course. You see this banyan tree we're sitting under? See how big and wide it is? How it stretches in all directions? And you see the thousands and thousands of seeds on this banyan tree? Within each fruit are tiny little seeds, hundreds of seeds. And this same God, my God, He has put an entire banyan tree in one of these little tiny seeds. Is that true? Did God put the whole banyan tree inside of the seed? Everyone has to say yes. Can you do that? Can your friends do that? Can your uncle or auntie do that? Can the Prime Minister of India do that? Can the President of the United States do that? Can Michael Jackson do that? Can the World Champion, World Wrestling Federation Champion do that? Does that mean nobody can? But we see that God is doing it. In every seed we see, every tree you see, came out of a tiny little seed, smaller than your fingertip. If God can make that, a banyan tree and a tiny little seed, what is the problem for Him to put the elephant through the eye of a needle? If God has created all the planets, all the oceans, and don't say it happened by chance. Things that happen by chance are chaotic, not organized. We have never seen in our history, in our own experience, anything happening by chance that is systematic and organized. How is it that the seasons come the same time every year? Since time immemorial. How is it that this earth is orbiting the sun and it never gets too close or too far? Are these things happening by chance? Or is there some organization behind this universal creation? Where there's organization, there's brain. Albert Einstein, the greatest scientist of the century, his conclusion was, there is mathematically, it's impossible that this earth and universe can be doing what it's doing without a brain. Mathematically, it's impossible. And that brain is what we mean by God. If God has such a brain and such power to create such a thing as this universe, is it a problem? Is it unbelievable for Him to put it on the hood of a serpent? What do you say? Is it unbelievable? Perfectly believable. Because God has revealed. If God creates the universe, doesn't He have the power to reveal to us how He's done it? And that's what the scriptures are. So if He explains this way, we accept it. It's not a problem. It's utterly believable. Only very small, crippled minds cannot believe such things. Only very egocentric people cannot believe these things. Because although they see miracles that are far beyond their comprehension at every moment, just in this material nature, they still think that if I can't do it, nobody can do it. Naham prakasa sarvasya yoga maya samavrata mudhoyam navijanati lokamam ajamavyayam. Krishna explains such people in the Gita. Those who are fools, who don't want to know, who don't want to see, who do not want to surrender, I cover them by my maya potency. And even though they're seeing the miracle of God everywhere around them, they don't believe that there's a God. Even though they're seeing miracles everywhere, they don't believe in miracles. even though they see achintya shakti, inconceivable potencies taking place in all directions. They can't believe in anything that they can't do themselves, or that the politicians or scientists or weightlifters can't do, or what can't be done with computers or machines. But everything around them is being done beyond the capacity of anyone or anything of this world. Is that true? Is there any difficulty in understanding and accepting it? It's common sense. But the problem, this world has lost common sense. They have uncommon nonsense instead of common sense. Power. That is the root of the problem. Any other questions?
If the God, the Supreme Power, has created his souls and these things, then why should they commit such sins? They all should be meant for good, doing good things. Everywhere there should be good things. Because everything is created by God.
Mm.
But why it is not changed?
Mm.
In this real world. Mm. Everything is expected to be good. Because everything is creation of God.
No, this world is not expected to be good. This world is expected to be bad. Pretty bold. I will explain that. In the state, the government makes so many good things, at least they're supposed to. But they also make a prison house for people who have chosen to be bad, to keep them away from the good people. The spiritual world is meant is everything is all good, because everyone wants to be good. But for those who don't want to be good, there has to be a place to keep them away from the spiritual world, and that's this material world. Durga means prison. Do you expect everyone to be good in a prison? No. Similarly, we don't expect to be everyone to be good in this material prison house. We've come to this material world because we want to enjoy separate from God. And the only way we can enjoy separate from God is we have to accept a position of ignorance. And God allows us to do that. Ultimately, we'll learn our lesson. But He allows us to do that. This is a prison which is meant to rectify our deviousness. But God comes. Krishna comes through so many avatars throughout history and sends so many of His divine representatives to teach everyone who wants to reform, come out of the prison and come to the place that actually is good. In one sense, the prison is good because it serves a good purpose. But what the people do in the prison is not good. And that's not because God wants it that way. It's because we want it that way. Does the government want people to be criminals? But there has to be a place for them. And here we are. But the doors are opened. The key is given to come out. Jesus Christ said, be in this world, but not of this world. Within the prison, there are also guards. There's also the warden. They're not prisoners. They're there to serve the prisoners, to help the prisoners. Right? That's what the saintly people come to do. Krishna's the warden. He comes into the world, but he's not of this world. And the great saints and rishis, according to their realization, they're beyond this world, but they're here for our sake, to help us to rectify ourselves and come out. One more question.
Maharaj, don't you... Maharaj, don't you think that if our ultimate purpose of human existence is to realize that we cannot enjoy material pleasures and to go back to Godhead, then don't you think that if Krishna would have given us the memory of our past lives and how we had bitterly suffered in our past lives, we would have engaged ourselves more and more urgently
we have already answered that question. There is no need for the technical details. There is no need. Because most people, they want to forget the technical details so that they could go on with their materialistic life. They want to forget those things. So Krishna says, all right, if you want, then forget. And those who want to remember, the principle is enough to have them rectify their condition. They don't have to know the details.
But what about those who don't have the belief, but who will have this belief after they get these details?
No, they won't. That is where you're wrong. They will not. And we can see that they will not. They don't want to know. They don't want to hear. Because they're attached. And even if you show them, they'll figure out some philosophy to justify how it's not true. Or there's nothing I can do about it. So if they don't want to know, Krishna just says, all right, then don't know. And if you do want to know, if you actually want to know, there's enough in your own experience to confirm the principles by which you'll take to the holy life, to spiritual life, to Krishna consciousness.
Maharaj, as far as I go, as far as my experiences of life are concerned, I think if I would have remembered all the
you think,
bad experiences
think,
of my past life, I would have been very urgent in Krishna consciousness.
No, if you remembered all your past experience, you would die immediately. You couldn't bear it.
But I will die thinking of Krishna.
No, you'll die thinking of all your bad experiences. Therefore, Krishna is giving you just enough suffering and enough pleasure now, and if you're inquisitive to know, he'll give you enough to convince you. But he convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You're wrong. If that was true, Krishna would show you everything of the past. But you don't want to know. You don't want to see it all. And you couldn't bear it if you did. It's too much. You would probably commit suicide if you saw all the things you've done in all your previous lives. You'd be so disgusted with yourself.
Why should I commit suicide? That would just make me more
Why
calm.
Should you? You shouldn't, but you would. Because you couldn't bear it all. You probably wouldn't have to. You would just die of anxiety and guilt. Huh? So therefore, you have to know that if you want to know, the philosophical principles and what you see in the world around you is enough if you want to know. And if you don't want to know, it doesn't matter how much God shows you. You won't change. Therefore, Krishna knows best. You don't know what's best. If you have a better way of conducting this creation, you should create your own universe. If you cannot create your own universe, you should accept that God knows better than you and accept the way he's doing things, the process that he's given for everyone to come to become perfect.
Maharaj, you gave the example of the prison being the material creation. Maharaj, don't you think that the prisoner, if he is able to remember that 2 days back he had received severe beatings by the prison warden, he will become more determined to get out of the prison rather than if he forgets about the beating and then his co-prisoner tells him that 2 days before you had received the beating.
People are getting beatings every day.
But they have forgotten that they have got the beatings.
They're forgetting the beatings 2 days ago, they're forgetting beatings 2 lives ago because they don't want to remember. You don't suffer at all in this world? Do you suffer? Ever?
But we have the hope of
I'm asking you. I'm asking you a question. Have you suffered?
No.
You've never suffered.
not that I consider itself to be a major suffering.
But you have suffered.
Very minimally.
Very minimally.
Yeah. So
and why you're coming to Krishna consciousness? And why you're asking all these questions about suffering?
Because Maharaj, I want to experience the sufferings which I had in my previous life.
You'll get yours.
And will come.
If you haven't got it yet, you'll get it in this life. And then when you get it, let's see whether you surrender to Krishna. You'll have the opportunity. Even in this birth, if when you were a child, you touched fire, and you have a big scar, a burn all over your arm, you know you touched fire. Anyone can tell you, you touched fire. Do you have to know exactly what age you were, exactly where you were, and when you touched the fire? Do you need to know all that? Oh, you have enough to know that you shouldn't touch fire anymore. Correct? In principle. There's no need for all this detail knowledge. It's just your reasoning is just a justification to not surrender. To understand the principle and the symptoms of what's before us right now today is enough for a sincere soul. So we should take the medicine. We should understand that we need the medicine and that the world needs the medicine. And chant the holy name.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
So we'll have just a few minutes of kirtan.
Just one last question. Not a meditation. Just one last question, one small question.
I don't think anyone believes you.
Maharaj, we tell that the nature has not given to anybody anything extra. The nature only gives a person only that much that is required. Then Maharaj, and we also say that Darwin's theory, it is completely nonsensical.
It's not completely nonsensical.
Then Maharaj, how do we explain the existence of vestigial organs in a human being? For example, the pinna of ear or the appendix. They don't have any function at all. And then why are these vestigial organs present in the human body?
You may not understand its function, but everything has a function.
So even these vestigial organs, they also have functions?
What is a vestigial organ?
Appendix.
Does everyone have one?
Yes. but Ayurveda says.
I have one too?
Yes.
It definitely has a function. Otherwise it wouldn't
have. Ayurveda says that it has got function.
What?
Ayurveda says it has function and clearly explained in Ayurveda.
The Ayurveda says they have function. You can explain to you later what the Ayurvedic version of their function is. But everything has a function. You may not understand its function, but you have to understand that science is an ever increasing, improving pursuit of truth. Is it not? Right now, medical science, aren't they always learning newer things? Is that true?
Yes.
Isn't that what scientific research is for? To learn more about biological nature and disease in the body? So there may be many, many things in this body that 100 years ago were said to have no function, but now it's discovered that it does have a function. And they may even be able to cure diseases by understanding those functions that they weren't able to do before because they didn't understand the function. Huh? So you may say that these particular organs have no function, but in 50 years, 100 years, maybe even 2 years, in the laboratories, they may find or discover that it has a very, very vital function that the body could not survive without. Isn't that happening all the time in medical research? New discoveries? Ayurveda already says it has a function, and medical science will discover the function in due course of time also. But God's creation of these bodies are very intricate, and everything has a function. The person who makes the automobile knows the function of every single part of the engine, the car, and everything. But a mechanic who doesn't know how and why he did it, he may understand certain functions and not understand others. But the Creator knows. And basically, what medical and scientific research is all about, all sciences, is just to further analyze and understand what the Creator has done in this world. But we'll never understand it in full. Only the Creator knows that. And in the scriptures, the Creator Himself is revealing. And He has revealed to us His holy name, from which all knowledge can be understood.